I may not be the next Toni Morrison, but there is a place for me on the shelf, right? Because there are a lot of books every month that come out. Why couldn't I be one of them?
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Laura Worrell, author of the novel Sweet, Soft, Plenty Rhythm. It's an unrequited love story about a jazz musician and the women who want him, which for Laura is almost a metaphor for her journey in publishing.
I did get to a point where I thought, if it doesn't work with this book, I think I'm done. Five books, 25 years, my entire adult life trying to get published. If it doesn't work with this book, which I really 100% believe in, it's just not in the cards for me.
Despite the long delay of her dream, it finally happened. Why, she says having her publishing debut at 50 gives her more perspective. Plus, how she continued to believe in her work and in herself through the decades of rejection. And the reason she says a happy ending won't always be in the cards for her characters, especially the weak ones. Laura shares her wisdom next when Black and Published continues. So, first question. When did you know that you were a writer?
I love this question. And the reason is that I don't believe there was ever a moment that I knew or that I realized, because it was just something that I was always doing. When I was a kid, I remember writing the name of a TV show after seeing it in a magazine or something like that. TV Guide, I think it was. And it was clear, I remember, to my mother that I was learning to write letters. And shortly after that, I was learning to write sentences. And then I was writing stories. So as soon as I started writing sentences, I started writing stories. So my mom has a book, well, a few books that I wrote when I was like 6 and 7. And I just have always written. I never stopped and really just became a part of who I am. I did make a decision, though. I wanted to be an actor. So that was a unique choice I knew from the people around me. And I knew I wanted to do it. So I went to a special high school. And when I first started college, I started as a theater major. But then I realized, what am I doing? I'm a writer. I've always been a writer. That's the thing that I've been doing, like drinking water and breathing and going to sleep. So let's do that. It was wonderful. It was smooth.
So that part is smooth, but what has your writing journey looked like since that decision? Has it been equally as smooth?
Not at all. It has not been, you know, it has not loved me. Well, I'll say this differently. The writing journey has been wonderful because I, like I said, I have not stopped writing from the time I was 6 years old to later today. I've been writing almost on a daily basis. I can't stop myself. And it's wonderful to have these characters come into my mind. It's wonderful to write their stories. It's so satisfying to have a Saturday night where I don't have plans and to decide to write. And it's just as satisfying as being out on a date or whatever else, or sometimes choosing to write because it brings me so much satisfaction. I love the act of writing. I'm not one of those writers who likes to have written. I like to write. Publishing has not been as loving to me as the craft. I finished my first novel when I was an undergrad, and I was about 25 years old when I decided to try to publish it. I didn't succeed in getting an agent. And so I wrote 4 other book. So Sweet, Soft, Plenty, Rhythm is actually my fifth book. And it took me about 25 years to finally get an agent and get a book into the world. So I was 50 when it happened. So I always like to differentiate, right, between writing, the craft, the joy, the pleasure, and sure, the frustration, but anything meaningful is going to be frustrating. Even your true love is going to have, you know, you're going to have bad days. But publishing has been, for me, a more challenging journey.
How have you maintained joy in the craft if the supposed outcome of that work was long delayed?
I'm not sure if I know the answer. Mm-hmm. One piece that I can say is that I love doing it so much. The act of sitting down in front of my computer, spending time with characters, trying to craft beautiful sentences, trying to make the story that's in my mind work on the page, seeing moments where some kind of inspiration comes to me out of the blue and really just locks in and makes the story really come alive. I love that feeling. When I have a story that I'm working on, when I have a book that I'm working on, it's always writing itself. When I've had, you know, especially boring jobs, it's writing itself. When I'm in the shower, when I'm walking down the street, things are happening. I have notes and napkins and now, you know, notes on my phone. It's love, right? I love the craft. And I have been able to, especially as I got older, make that distinction between writing and publishing. And so because I loved it so much and because I believed in the work and believed in myself, and not only thinking I'm the next best thing, for sure, that's not the case, but knowing, and I think this is true for most writers, I may not be the next Toni Morrison, but there is a place for me on the shelf, right? I do have talent. I do have a story, and there can be a place for me because there are a lot of books every month that come out. Why couldn't I be one of them? And so I feel like the first piece was, I love this and I need to keep doing this. I can't stop myself and I'm not going to take that away from my days just because I'm not succeeding yet at it. But then also believing there's a place for me. Now, I won't lie. This journey with this particular book getting published was challenging. And I did get to a point where I thought, if it doesn't work with this book, I think I'm done. Five books, 25 years, my entire adult life trying to get published. If it doesn't work with this book, which I really 100% believe in, it's just not in the cards for me. But I think, like I said, that's what I fell back on. And I often tell students this, you've really got to love this work because the business is challenging and the process is long of writing.
The quote that people always say is running through my head, like it's right at the moment where you want to give up that everything happens.
Right.
So now let's talk about this long journey of publication. You mentioned that if Sweet Soft Plenty Rhythm didn't go, you were kind of going to be like, threw your hands up. So take us through the steps. When did you finish the manuscript? When did you query? How did all that go? How long did it take?
Sure. So I finished the manuscript. I started it in 2013. It was a short story at the end of my MFA program. I was still living in Boston. And I finished the book in 2018. So that means it took me about 4 or 5 years to write. So there were periods during those years where I had to put the book on the shelf for a little bit to focus on other things in my life. I guess probably 2018, I started querying agents. And by that time, I had been through this process with 4 other books. I had lived in 3 American cities, Boston, New York, and Los Angeles, that are, you know, especially New York and to a lesser extent, Boston, publishing hubs. New York is where the business is. And when I lived in those cities, I busted my tail to network, to take classes, to meet people, to do everything you're supposed to do to endear yourself, right, to the community and to start to know people. And so by the time I started looking for an agent, I knew a lot of writers. And the first several batches of queries that I sent out were to agents who other writers had recommended to me. And that's supposed to be a shoe-in. Not necessarily that you're going to get one of those agents, but you're definitely supposed to get your book read and maybe have a better chance of being considered because, right, you're a real person now. You're not just a name on a piece of paper. And all of those agents either rejected me, some of them didn't respond to me at all, which was very surprising. And others, it just took a long time before they got back to me, and I either decided they're not interested. And that was very shocking. And not because, I mean, I really believe like this is it. I've really written a good book here, but it was very harsh, you know, to come against this. I had been used to, I'm just cold querying agents, right? But I was getting a lot of the same response when I was querying agents who I had a connection to, right? So that was really demoralizing. And then it took me basically 2 years, 50 queries. Mm-hmm. But what happened between those 2 years, within those 2 years, is that I would listen to what the agents were telling me. And if there were pieces of feedback that seemed useful and that would make the manuscript better and align with my vision for it, I took that to heart and I revised. There was one agent in particular who, from the beginning, offered feedback and really serious recommendations for revisions. And I, again, took those to heart. So the book went through a lot of revisions during those 2 years. And then I would go back out with another batch of queries, get rejected or ignored, and then go back to the drawing board with whatever information I did get. So I was constantly revising. Then by the end of the journey, I really had done a lot of revisions. I sent it to a book doctor. Her job is to look at a manuscript and say, this is working, this isn't working, et cetera. And I paid her. She was fantastic. She used to be an editor at Tin House. And I gave her the manuscript and she gave me feedback. And once again, I made those changes. And then I sent out another batch of queries and found my agent. And he kind of took over. So I didn't have anything else to worry about. And that was a wonderful, wonderful moment because it was, I mean, there was the next mountain to climb, right? But that was a mountain that I was really glad to finally have reached the peak of.
Did you do more revisions with your agent before he went on submission?
I didn't really have to. By the time I got to him, the manuscript was pretty polished, right? Because I'd gone through all these other revisions. I'd sent it to a book doctor. I feel like maybe there was a chapter or two that we decided to drop, but there weren't really any significant revisions. And even when we finally made the deal and I started working with my editor at the publisher, we didn't really have a lot of revisions either. I think we let another chapter go. And I'm not suggesting like my writing is so fantastic. I think it's just because I had revised it over and over and over again during those 2 years that it was pretty sharp by the time I got it into their hands.
I remember first hearing about your book in that New York Times article where they profiled Lisa Lucas of Pantheon. Mm-hmm. And it was basically, it's about her, but it's about her and her love for your book. Mm-hmm. And so then it was like, everyone's like, what is this book that's coming out? Yeah. We have to read it.
Right.
And so after so many years of working toward this moment, how did it feel to have, I guess, such a big, grand debut onto the literary scene in that way?
It was really humbling. It was really exciting. I was very, very grateful. One of the things that I've said a bunch of times, because it's true, is even though it was a bummer that this took so long, that I was 50, you know, if you would have told me when I was 17, thinking, I'm going to be a successful writer, somebody would have said, no, it's not going to happen until you're 50. I don't know if I would have, you know what I mean? But I think the benefit to being older is being able to manage it, being able to manage expectations, to take what comes and to be grateful for it and to be excited about it and to not take personally or let myself be devastated by things that don't turn out the way that I hope. Because even the people with what appear to be the most successful books of the season are probably frustrated by, why am I not on that list? Why did that happen to such and such and it didn't happen to me? What does it mean for my career? And I think that being an older author, and 50 is not necessarily that old, but I was not necessarily expecting the book to, you know, make a splash. I think people dream about that, but I have been around long enough to know that that doesn't usually happen. So it was pretty exciting that, you know, it was in the New York Times. Well, first of all, it was really exciting to just be working with Lisa. Once I knew that she was interested in the book, and once I met her, I was just absolutely thrilled. I mean, she's a rock star in this field. And so to be able to work with her was already thrilling. And then, yeah, the book was getting buzz. It was getting featured in places, you know, it was in Oprah, it was in Vanity Fair, it was in People magazine, you know, that you dream of. And it's been really deeply satisfying. I have been very happy on a very deep level because, you know, when your dream comes true, that's sort of an empty thing to say. My dream comes true. Well, what does that mean? Mm. And for me as a writer, what it means is I get to keep doing the thing I love with fewer obstacles, right? It's not just, ooh, I'm famous now. That's not what it is for me. For me, it's, and right now I get to do it. It's not going to last. I'm going to have to go back to teaching, and that's not necessarily a problem. But for now, I wake up, I make myself a cup of coffee, I write. Mm. That's the dream.
That is the dream. It's my dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And hopefully, if all continues to go well, people will expect each one of my projects, and there will be people who will probably read them. You know, I want to share my work. It's my contribution, right? Here, entertain yourself, or hopefully you'll see something in this book that helps you along in your journey. And I get to keep doing that. And so, so that's the dream. So I am, like I said, I'm incredibly grateful.
I love that. Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let's do the reading and talk about this book and these women and this man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Black and Published family, it's time for the reading. Sweet, Soft, Plenty Rhythm follows the life and underrated career of Circus Palmer, a playboy jazz musician whose one true love drops a bomb on him he can't handle and causes a spiral that affects not only him, but the lives of every other woman connected to him. Here's Laura.
I'll read just a little bit from the introduction. The girl may have been the end for him, the end's beginning, like the bend of a road too slight to notice where it leads. She could have happened to him a day later or a day before, but she was there on that day, in that moment, just hours after Circus Palmer turned 40, a predictable time for a certain kind of end to come, and just seconds after Maggie slid her hand from his wrist and whispered, "I have something to tell you." Outstretched on a chair beside the hotel pool, Circus watched from a distance as the girl, in her mid-20s, he figured, did cartwheels alone on the beach, her linen skirt falling open to bare the smooth plane of her hips and the slide of her calves sloping up to her toes. She lured his eyes away from Maggie, who was lying in another chair beside him. All afternoon, Maggie had been acting strangely, staring at nothing and losing the thread of conversations. This wasn't Maggie. Circus figured whatever it was she had to say wasn't anything he wanted to hear, so he let his attention be taken by the girl doing flips back and forth across the sand. When she landed on her feet, her hair lashed across her back like a whip, her shoulders lifted and hands spread beneath the melon sunset as if she carried it on her fingertips. Hips, calves, toes, shoulders, hands, she circled in the air again. I wasn't going to say anything. Maggie hummed, the sound not fully making its way to him, not quite breaking through his focus. But I thought you should know. If she were any other woman, he would have told her to come to the point. But this was Maggie, so he waited, a sense of dread needling in his gut. Chewing at the inside of his cheek, always his mouth needed something to do, he concentrated on the melody the girl made inside his head as he tapped a nervous rhythm on his knee. Listen to what I'm telling you. The push in Maggie's voice, major keyed and salty, brought Circus back to the cabana, back to the world, wild turkey warm in his glass, and Maggie beside him. Her lips were pursed as she stroked her long neck and watched the night begin to fall, possibly without noticing the girl, possibly trying not to. He'd come to Miami to draw a clean line between his first 40 years and his next, and it invited Maggie because she was the only female in his life who knew how to be easy. He didn't love traveling with women. A woman in the room meant ending the night back at the hotel where she was waiting. "Sorry, baby," he stroked her knee. "I'm listening." "I was late," she said, "so I took the test." He let out a hard breath he didn't know had been stuck in his throat and waited for her to smile, to laugh, to do something to let him know she was joking. "I don't believe it." "Believe, sugar. We're careful. Only sometimes. You sure it's mine?" The corner of her mouth lifted. "Nice try." I'll stop there. Gives you a sense of where you're headed if you decide to take this journey.
I didn't know what to expect when I started this book. And as I continue reading it, I understand how, like, the man moves through the lives of all these women. And what I was most intrigued by was how music was the constant in his life. And it was, he was loving one thing, the women were loving him, and everybody had unrequited love. Where did that come from?
I like the way you've said that. It hasn't been phrased like that before, but I really think you've hit the nail on the head. His love is also unrequited. He loves music. And similar to what I was saying about my writing, music is not loving him back, right? He doesn't get to focus on it and devote himself to it the way he wants to. But I also think Circus is, despite what he says, searching for some fame. He's searching for some greater recognition than what he's getting in his life as a local musician in Boston. The idea came to me because I was involved with a musician and he was slippery. He was devoted to his music in a way that he was not devoted to anything else, let alone women and relationships. And I think it's a very common story out in the world. It's also been a part of our literature for centuries, right? Lotharios and Don Juans. And I wanted to write a story from the perspective of the women because I feel like, as is often the case with literature and storytelling in general, we tell stories that men and women are both a part of, but it's the male's perspective, his journey, his trajectory, his growth and evolution that is prioritized, that we are supposed to be interested in. And the woman is serving all of that. And I wanted to extract women from that narrative and show all of the layers and complications and depths and impacts of this kind of relationship, because I don't think it's been done very often. If at all, I can't think of many.
I've right. never read anything like it.
Right, right. And so that was one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book. But going back to your point about unrequited love, I wanted to make sure that Circus wasn't just this jerk player, right? I wanted him to have something that was intriguing beyond him just being handsome or sexy. And to me, being a creative person, I know so many people, but especially women, who have their type. I like musicians. I like actors. I knew a woman when I was in college, I worked in a comedy club. She really liked stand-up comics. And so I thought, well, let's dig into what it is about the creative man, this idea that as women, our internal life has not been considered as important or valued or intriguing as the internal life of men. And so very often I feel like women get fed creatively from
the creative man.
The creative man, right? Is it really him or is it something in yourself? And so that's why I wanted him to be a musician, jazz musician, because it confuses a lot of people. And I liked playing with this idea that these women are really attracted to him, but maybe don't actually like jazz or aren't as familiar and are kind of confused by it. So there are lots of layers to that dynamic.
Do you think you love writing as much as Circus loves music?
I think I am devoted to the craft more than he is, because I think that he is devoted, but I don't think he's going where he needs to go to get better. So, you know, I described my publishing journey. And part of that journey was when I got feedback that made sense.
You revised.
I revised. I don't think Circus would revise.
He didn't.
I think Circus is like, well, you just don't get me. Or you just don't appreciate what I do. I don't think, and one of the other characters says to him, the jazz musician that I sort of see as his mentor, is you've always been a little afraid of the music. You're afraid to go there. And I think that that's what distinguishes proficient artists from unique artists, let alone people who are really innovating their fields or their craft. And I don't think Circus would do that. I think he's too arrogant. I think he's too locked into himself, too afraid to go there.
It reminds me of a line, I don't remember the artist who said it, but in the documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom.
And it's saw that, I loved that, yeah.
I did too, but it's in the beginning of the documentary where it's like, you know, it's a long walk. Like you may think it's only 20 feet, but it's a long walk to center stage. And with so much of Circus's, I guess, fear being wrapped up in him not getting to the center, you describe it best. And I told you we're going to talk about this.
Mm-hmm. Great.
On page 332, the line, it's a quote. I don't remember who's talking. It says, you're like, you know, you're going to hit a moment in life when there's nowhere else for you to go. You're not going any farther. Everything you're going to do and be is already in place. So you hit that plateau, right? And just coast until the end. That's okay if you like where you are, but if not, and then the sentence trails and the ellipses. And I was like, I can't do this with Laura today. Like, I didn't ask for this.
Yeah.
So, like, it's talking about the character and music, but then were you also talking to yourself about writing?
It was definitely me talking to myself, and it was me talking to all of us, you know? And I think that there are two. It's funny, I've been thinking a lot about this because I am getting older and you hit an age where you think this is going to end my life, right? I'm not going to be here forever. And what do I want to do with that life? And I do feel I hit that moment. I know a lot of people who've hit that moment. I think you hit that moment at varying ages where you realize I might be constructing a life that it's going to be more challenging to get out of if I realize that it's not working for me anymore. And I think part of that is before you get to that point, do your best, right, to construct a life that when you hit that point, you go, okay, well, this is okay. I just need a couple adjustments, right? And the unfortunate thing that happens to a lot of creative people is that there are a lot of creative people. I considered myself one of them until I got lucky and found the right people for this project, where it's not you. It's not that you're not working hard enough. It's not that you're not good. It just didn't. I mean, again, I live in Los Angeles. This town is full of beautiful, talented, interesting, exciting people who just didn't get a break. And it's not their faults. Right. Yeah. It's not, there's nothing that they could have done differently. It just didn't happen. And so, yeah, I mean, for sure, I was talking to myself and I was talking to all of us. The question that I'm always trying to answer is how do we live our lives in a way that makes us feel that our lives are meaningful? And in this book, it's, you know, part of that question revolves around relationship, and especially when relationships are so challenging and we have so many blockages, right? These characters are all challenged in some way, right? Because they're in this relationship with him and he's in this relationship with all of these women.
Mm-hmm. So then let's talk about the women, because I think the most devastating one for me was Pia. I was just like, WTF at the end of her section.
Right.
Why that ending for her? And
yeah.
So for the backstory, because I don't want to spoil anything, mm-hmm. but Pia is Circus's wife and they have the daughter together that we mentioned before. And then she makes an abrupt decision because she wasn't living a life that she, I guess, enjoyed. But then I felt like her decision was even more destructive than the life that she was living.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I'm going to give you a little insider tip as a writer to writer. That's why your reaction, right? That's part of it. I mean, because if you just would have read the book and went, oh, okay, what's next? You didn't have, now I understand if you don't like her and you're mad because nobody likes her. My mom called me after she read the book. She's like, I don't like Pia. But I feel like, you know, you want to have in fiction, people can't always make choices that we admire, right? Okay. If every single one of those women made choices where at the end you were going, clapping for them, right? It wouldn't be real. They're not all going to make decisions that are empowering, that are uplifting, right? That you get to sing a song at the end of their chapters. And to me also, and this is, I think, also very important to writing, is having characters that are so real that they're going to make decisions that are true to them. And where she started and where she ended up makes sense for who she is, right?
Yeah.
She's very, very weak. Her soul is weak versus Maggie, Circus, the woman who's pregnant in the first chapter, who is strong. She doesn't need him. She doesn't need anybody, right? So how do I write an arc for Pia that is both riveting for fiction, because that's part of the job, right? But also true to who she is. But the decision that she makes alters the playing field for everybody else. And for Coco, who is her daughter, and for Circus, who is her ex-husband. And that's exciting. That's interesting. And to me, the most important character in the book is Coco, Circus's daughter. And Pia's actions push her on a trajectory that she wasn't going on her own, right? Shifts it in a way that I think is really important and transformative for her.
I think my favorite women were Maggie mm-hmm. and I believe Josephine. Mm-hmm. Because the way she responds to Circus and then ultimately changes all of his life. At the end of the novel, it seems like, you know, everyone is where they're supposed to be, even though they feel like they're still missing something. Is that your take on it, or what you were trying to get at? And then what do you want readers to take from that?
Without giving too much away, I like to think of this book, as I said earlier, as an invitation, right? Circus learns in the first chapter that Maggie is pregnant. And so he connects or reconnects with all of these other women because he's kind of at a crisis moment. What's he going to do about Maggie's pregnancy? What does this mean for him and his future? It's messing with him, Maggie's pregnancy, because he actually, of all of these women, Maggie's the one who's got his heart, but he really doesn't want to commit to anybody or anything. And he's at this moment where he's got this opportunity with his music. So for all of these women, the invitation is, what are you going to do about this relationship? Are you going to let this guy keep coming around and not giving you what you want? Are you going to let him take advantage of you? Or are you going to, as I say, end the relationship, withdraw, And I don't want to give away what each of these women do or how their story with Circus ends up, but I felt like it would be more honest if not everybody is necessarily ending the book with their lives in total bliss and, you know,
happy
repair.
Endings. Yeah.
Yeah. Not everybody can have a happy ending.
Yeah.
But I think some of them do. Some of these women do say, you're out of here. I don't want to be with you anymore. If you're not going to treat me the way I need to be treated, then you're gone. Other women are going to make different decisions. Other women are still going to be longing for this guy. But everybody ends up in a different place than they started. Every woman in this book ends the story with a future ahead of them that has shifted.
Mm-hmm.
Something new can now happen because of the journey they went on with Circus in the book. And to answer the other piece of your question, I know this isn't for everyone. I know this isn't for every reader. But for me as a reader and thus as a writer, I like stories that reflect the complications of life, that life isn't always going to offer happy endings, and that there is meaning even when the ending isn't happy. And I guess that's what I'm trying to leave readers with, is that there is always the opportunity for us to change our lives, especially any of us who are in relationships like this, which are a lot of us, right? Including men. Lots of people are in relationships with people who are not giving them what they want. And not only do I want to sort of validate that experience, right? But also to, you know, leave readers with the idea that the change is possible, that evolution is necessary, that confronting yourself and your decisions helps you liberate yourself from what you need liberation from. And it might not always be sunshine and rainbows, but movement forward is what our lives are about, I think.
So then on that note, what's next?
So I'm
a fan now. Yeah, I'm a fan. So what's next?
It's so nice to meet fans. So I'm working now on a book about an affair. And we're still prioritizing female characters, centering female characters. But now we're talking about people who are committed. We're talking about people who are in it for the long haul, and some of the challenges that can come with that.
All right. So I want to switch to a speed round and a game before I let you go for the afternoon. What is your favorite book?
Jazz by Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison is definitely my favorite writer. And for whatever reason, jazz just, I mean, even talking about it now, it just gripped me. And so I think it's not only loving the book, I think that it just spoke to me more than probably any other book. That first page that starts, I know that woman. I have read that over and over and over. It's one of my favorite pieces of writing in all of literature. I have read it to other people and have teared up. I just think it's gorgeous. It's right down my alley, the way she writes about relationships, the language in it, the fact that, I mean, I just, that's it. It's jazz.
Okay. Yeah. You've already said Toni Morrison is your favorite author. So then what is your favorite song?
Oh, God. It would probably be something by Prince.
Okay.
I mean, then there's like jazz and stuff like that. Charles Mingus, I think, is my favorite. Or Thelonious Monk, although I just discovered this record by Alice Coltrane. But those are some of my favorites.
It's fine. If you were throwing a dinner party with writers and musicians, who would you invite?
Dead or alive?
Doesn't matter.
Okay. So Toni Morrison for sure, James Baldwin, Prince, Charles Mingus, and Thelonious Monk and stuff. And I'm trying to think of who would really be really interesting. Wynton Marcellus, he's much more contemporary. So then Questlove also. Chuck D, I just saw him on something. I love Public Enemy and I love his mind. Why don't I just stop there? That would be a good party.
That would be a good party. If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
if money were no object, I would travel the world. I wouldn't go one place. I would just live in different places. I would love to do that, actually. And in some ways, I consider, is there a way that I can do that? Like, I would go live somewhere in South America for a couple of years, and then I would go live somewhere in Europe, and then I would live somewhere in Africa. And yeah, I really, travel is incredibly important to me. So what I would do is that I would take my computer and just go live in different parts of the world until I was ready to move to a different place, and then go and keep writing books the whole time.
Okay. So then yeah. Name three things on your bucket list.
A lot of it is travel related. At some point, I want to take a trip around the world. I'd also like to have one of the languages that I speak terribly. I'd like to speak one of them well.
What languages do you speak?
So I have some French, German, and Spanish. But if anybody started talking to me, I would embarrass myself. But but if I could get one of them like solid, that would be great. Or even like Italian. I have this Italian friend. I'm like, oh, it's so pretty. And then the third thing, it's so much more abstract than a bucket list. I just want to create a life where I can balance work and administrative stuff. Maybe that's why it's hard for me to come up with a bucket list, because I'm really trying to strive toward a life where I'm doing things that are meaningful, so I don't have to put them into a bucket. Mm. But as soon as we get off this call, I'm going to think of like 14 things I could have told you. Or maybe I should just like start a bucket list. I don't know. But yeah.
All right. And then what brings you joy?
So the people that I love bring me a lot of joy. I love meaningful, rich, stimulating conversations with the people I love. I like being in the company of the people that I love, but I also feel so much joy in other people's creative work. Mm. Listening to a record that I love by a musician that I think is brilliant, going to a museum and seeing artwork that I think is moving, reading a book that is blowing my mind. Even if I don't know the person, seeing another person's creativity and being moved by it is not only joyful, but inspirational. And I want to write. I want to talk. I just feel alive. I feel like there's sunshine in my chest. Mm. That's what brings me joy.
All right. So our game is called Rewriting the Classics. Mm. Name one book you wish you would have written.
Hmm. That's really hard. I guess I might say Gorilla, My Love.
Gay Bambara?
Yeah. When I read that book, I didn't feel like, God, I wish I wrote this. But I did feel like, I wish I could write like this. And how is she doing that? So that might be the book that I say. There have been a lot of books. It's interesting. I don't think I necessarily have that relationship with the books I read, you know, of like, oh man, but I do feel more like this is now teaching me.
Yeah. Name a book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
I just thought of one, but it's a contemporary writer and I'm not going to say. All I'll say is there were several relationships in the book that I'm thinking of. And the couple that ended up together, I was not satisfied. And yeah, that's all I'll say.
Okay.
I'm
going to ask you when I stop the recording. I'm going to come back to it because now I want to know. You may not answer this question either because it is my messy question.
Okay.
But name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught and why? And you can do dead writers if that makes you feel better.
Yeah, I would do somebody dead for sure. let's see. I'm going to say Raymond Carver for two reasons. I teach, like I told you, I teach literature classes. And there's a story called Cathedral that is in almost every literature textbook I've had my hands on. Cathedral by Raymond Carver. I love Raymond Carver. I think he was a great writer. I've learned a lot from him. But I think that A, he's held up as the standard for American literature that is limiting. I think he should definitely be included, but not necessarily like this is the end all be all. I also feel like Cathedral is not his most exciting story. I'm sure if he was alive, he'd be like, you know, I wrote other stories.
Yeah.
You know, so I would say that.
Okay. And so then my final question for you today is, when you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the words and work that you left behind?
I hope that they say that I told stories from the perspectives of people that we don't always get to hear from. That I wrote about the human condition and the human experience from a unique perspective that provided even a tiny, tiny, tiny light, shone a very, very tiny light on that experience so that there's more understanding of what it means to be human and why we're here. And I say that not to suggest that my work is that profound, but that I think that what great art does is reflect the human experience in meaningful ways that we can understand ourselves and each other and life. And I hope that my work contributes in a small way to that.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Laura Worrell for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Laura's debut novel, Sweet, Soft, Plenty Rhythm, out now from Pantheon Books. And if you're not following Laura, check her out on the socials. She's at LK Worrell on Twitter and Instagram. And Worrell is Warrell. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Laura about why she doesn't regret the book doctor she worked with and how to avoid publishing scams. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Victor Laval, author of Lone Women.
One of the things that interests me very much is talking about the ways that someone outside the family harms family. Mm. But then I'm deeply invested in telling the truth about how within family we hurt each other, right? And that on some level, like the deepest horror, to me at least, is the people who are supposed to love you and supposed to keep you safe are the ones who don't.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.